From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
An atheist chaplain would be the last person in the world that we would want a dying soldier who needs that last moment counseling in their life.
That's Representative John Fleming of Louisiana, who sponsored an amendment to the appropriations bill to block the appointment of humanist and atheist chaplains for U.S. service members. There were plenty of incredibly misguided, hostile, and hateful reactions to the recent debate in Congress on this issue. These so-called defenders of faith can rest easy. A ban on such appointments passed resoundingly last month. But the debate unleashed such a torrent of ignorance, it seemed incumbent on us to examine the matter in a responsible way. And on this week's show, we're going to do just that with the help of a real, live humanist chaplain, not in the military, but at Harvard University, when our friend Chris Stedman returns to State of Belief Radio.
Jeopardizing these institutions' constitutional rights to freely exercise religion.
I rise to defend the Second Amendment to our Constitution.
May make free speech a felony.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is flat out unconstitutional.
Even as the Constitution gets invoked with unremitting frequency, Americans' knowledge of at least the First Amendment is at record lows, according to the latest State of the First Amendment survey by the highly respected First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University and the Newseum. On this week's show, we'll dig into the findings with Charles Haynes, director of the Religious Freedom Education Project at the Newseum. But first,
these stand your ground laws encourage a vigilante mentality, and 31 states have this law.
There's been little let up in the ongoing debate of so-called stand your ground laws since the George Zimmerman verdict in Florida last month. Activists occupied the Florida State House, and the issue has been raised in many other places as well. As the question of racial justice raised by the death of Trayvon Martin continues to be central to the conversation, as it should be, a fascinating take on the principle of stand your ground laws appeared in the Washington Post On Faith section. Its author, Susan Brooks Thistlewaite, is a writer, a theologian who teaches at Chicago Theological Seminary, and I'm very pleased to welcome back Professor Thistlewaite to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Will.
In your article, headlined, Let's Not Just Have Another Conversation on Race, you go right at the moral failings that are represented by Stand Your Ground laws. Interestingly, you call such laws a temptation.
Well, let's take a figure like this. Since Florida's Stand Your Ground law became effective in 2005, the rate of homicides that have been claimed to be legally justified in Florida has jumped 300%. Now, the right to self-defense is an important right. I mean, it has been contested in the history of Christian theology. For example, Augustine, who is widely credited with coming up with just war theory, was not certain that even self-defense could be a reason for using force against another. Augustine says that you could only use force in the defense of the vulnerable other. Mm-hmm. But from Roman law, and especially the influence of castle doctrine, you're supposed to be able to defend your castle. These two streams come together in Western law, and there is a right to defend yourself in a reasonable manner from imminent danger. Now, what ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, along with the National Rifle Association, did was to rewrite these laws so that not only is it not your home anymore, it's anywhere you are where you're not engaged in criminal activity, and the stand your ground laws also, for example, are named as a reason why George Zimmerman was not originally arrested. And then, of course, none of the toxicology, no drug testing, no alcohol testing, is available on mm-hmm. George Zimmerman. So then, of course, when you get to the court case, that's not there.
Mm-hmm.
Trayvon Martin, who was killed, was tested.
Yeah.
So you've got a situation where someone who uses deadly force against another person is likely not to be charged with homicide if they can claim a much, much, much more expanded understanding of self-defense. And it is clearly tempting people, the 300% figure jumps out at you,
mm-hmm.
to claim this in relationship to homicide.
I like the way you put it in the article. You said that stand your ground laws create an environment where deadly force becomes a weapon of first resort as opposed to last resort.
Yes, and I'm referencing there the last resort criterion of just war theory. And, you know, it's always been the case in self-defense, for example, that if you have a way to run away, you are supposed to do that rather than use deadly force. That's, of course, in traditional legal understandings of self-defense. But now, with stand your ground, that's not necessary. So you can use force and, in a lot of cases, get away with it. Now, not if you're an African-American woman, though. Marissa Alexander, and you know this case,
right?
Florida African-American woman, she's got a restraining order out on her husband. He nevertheless comes to, she feels, use the force against her that he has used in the past. She goes and gets a gun and fires into the air, claimed stand your ground, and she was given 20 years.
Yeah.
She didn't shoot him. She just shot into the air.
Yeah.
And so it's there's also a question, well, in terms of the temptation that it follows our fault lines on
mm-hmm.
race, on gender. So who gets to be considered worthy of using deadly force? Who's unworthy? You don't see Alec and the NRA rushing to arm battered women so that they can stand their ground, or to arm African-American teenagers who might be at risk from self-appointed
mm-hmm.
Community watch people. That's not been the response.
Susan, talk a little deeper in theological terms about the question of morality when it comes to stand your ground. And in your article, you also tie that in with New York City's notorious stop and frisk policy.
I have gone further than that. I mean, I really do believe that stop and frisk, because as the American Civil Liberties Union and others have documented, it is so unequally applied in relationship to African-American, Hispanic, primarily males, though some females. It's a strategy of intimidation, and it is a law that I think is basically unconstitutional. The concept that you are entitled as a person who is employed to keep the peace, to harass people in this way, I cannot imagine, but that is not bad for the character of the people who suddenly feel this sense of entitlement that they don't need particular evidence to be able to do this to people. That's kind of bad for people's character,
mm-hmm.
and it will tempt you to the lowest forms of behavior.
Too often in our country, it seems the debate on public safety, just like on immigration or war making, devolves into a primitive cowboy level of rhetoric. More and more, we mm-hmm. see lawmakers descend to that level also. So, Susan, how do you discuss just war theory with people who are chanting all the while, USA, USA, or Zimmerman, Zimmerman?
It's worse than you think. Well, in the 1980s, the first of these laws that then became Stand Your Ground laws were nicknamed Make My Day laws.
Mm, mm.
Very much betraying that kind of cowboy ethic mm. from Clint Eastwood films. When tempers are hot, it's not a good time for peacemaking. The time is in our social locations, our school locations, our work locations, our radio communications. Mm-hmm. You know, I do a lot of radio, and so do you, and I do a lot of online blogging. People just post the most appalling things. It's another form of temptation, I think, when mm-hmm. they can do so anonymously, because then they get to escape responsibility. And what is temptation, right? What is temptation mm-hmm. but thinking you're not going to have to be accountable? And so we need to practice nonviolent communication. We need to practice good, affirming listening. We need to practice anti-bullying. And whether it's online or whether it's in the radio or whether it's in the workplace, wherever it is, that's the time, because this is a social transformation that I think we desperately need in this country. But it's a grassroots change that has to come. And there's a lot of parents, and I'm a grandparent now, and I think to myself, do I want my baby grandchildren to grow up in this world where they have to be afraid of being cyberbullied? You know,
yes.
Every parent, every grandparent, everyone who cares about children can be invested in changing these forms of communication. And there are wonderful, like Peace Games and other groups who work on getting kids to learn different schoolyard behaviors. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of teachers and principals, I think, who would be really, really interested in having this kind of communication learned in their schools. So that's where we have to start. You really can't get there from here when people are screaming at each other. Need to kind of send people to their rooms and say, mm-hmm. calm down, mm-hmm. and then try to come at it. And, you know, our churches, our synagogues, our mosques, wouldn't it be great if our churches learned nonviolent communication so when they were making a budget, they would communicate well? I mean, I don't think there's a pastor in the United States who wouldn't want to sign up for that.
Right.
And you know, the best way to teach communication is how you communicate with people.
Right. The Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite is professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Susan's writing appears frequently in the Washington Post and elsewhere, and I encourage you to take time to read her column, Let's Not Just Have Another Conversation on Race. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Susan, as always, I appreciate you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Reverend Gotti. It's you know, the work that you do helps people heal from the kinds of tears in the social fabric that we experience so much today. And so I want to thank you for that.
Still to come on this week's show, Chris Stedman will be here to take issue with those who've been ridiculing the concept of humanist chaplains. The First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University and the Newseum here in Washington is a vitally important resource for studying, teaching, and observing the ongoing role of this crucial part of the United States Constitution. As part of its work, the center conducts an annual State of the First Amendment survey, and the latest results are now out. Frankly, things don't look so good. Here with some of the highlights is Dr. Charles Haynes, who is director of the Religious Freedom Education Project at the Newseum. Charles, it's great to have you with us again on State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Welton. Good to be with you.
Charles, I'm not sure, as the host of this program, if I should be more alarmed at the percentage of respondents who consider freedom of the press to be an important right protected by the First Amendment, 1%, or by the astounding change in how many Americans think the amendment grants too many rights, 13% last year, 34% this year thinks the First Amendment grants too many rights. I'm astounded. What were you most alarmed by?
Well, the first thing I was alarmed about is that we have more than a third of Americans, 34%, who thinks the First Amendment goes too far. And embedded in that, there are a high percentage of those folks are young people. So that's even scarier to me. I mean, it's one thing if people who, you know, been around a while think it goes too far, but if the coming generation thinks that we have too much freedom under the First Amendment, that makes me worry. the other finding that is deeply disturbing to me, as I'm sure it was to you, is that so many Americans think that the United States Constitution establishes a Christian nation. A majority of people say they agree with that. And that's a frightening statistic, I think.
Well, I certainly agree. Would you attribute this to complacency or a lack of education or the work of the revisionist historians or something else?
It's probably a combination of things, Walton, but I think that it's certainly a result of some of the propaganda from folks on the far right who have been peddling the false notion that somehow the United States was founded to be a Christian nation. Perhaps many Americans, when they're asked that question, hear something like, did our framers or founders intend for us to be a Christian country? Well, probably most of them envisioned that the culture would be Christian in nature. After all, almost everybody was Christian at the time. But when we asked, does the U.S. Constitution establish a Christian nation? I really frankly expected most people to say, well, wait a minute, no, that's different. It doesn't it's a secular state. But in fact, a majority of Americans, when they hear that question, say, yes, that's right, it establishes a Christian nation. So that's deeply concerning to me.
Is there a particularly significant area of the survey that you see as changing most dramatically over these past 17 years?
Well, I think the most dramatic thing in this survey is not something that we've asked before exactly, but this taking the temperature on how people feel about gay rights. And I think that this survey shows that, you know, as other surveys have shown, that Americans have changed their mind on that issue. And this year we found out that a significant majority of Americans believe that gay couples and gay same-sex couples should not be discriminated against by organizations, even religiously affiliated organizations that receive government funds, that should provide benefits to same-sex couples that work for them, and businesses that serve weddings, for example, should be required to treat everybody the same way. Same-sex couples should be served. So, and that's a smaller majority, but nevertheless, I think it's significant that so many Americans now believe that non-discrimination really does trump some of the religious liberty claims of groups that are opposed to same-sex marriage.
The change that we've seen in public attitudes towards gay rights, that's a very progressive change in our nation. And yet at the same time in this survey, we see less support for a freedom like religious freedom. And religious freedom is now going to be tested somewhat as never before because of the gay rights situation.
I think that's right. I mean, in some ways, these culture war battles over gay rights and abortion give religious freedom a bad name, I would say. That is to say, many Americans now just associate religious liberty claims with voices of those who do not support same-sex marriage, for example, or who believe that all abortion should be banned. So, you know, when people associate religious liberty with those viewpoints, their support for religious liberty diminishes, I think. Conservative religious people who have those deep convictions ought to be aware of that and reach out and say, we want to protect our rights and our freedom, but we're not doing it in a way that would discriminate against other people. If they could find ways to do that more clearly, then I think it would help the cause of religious freedom, frankly.
How do you think Americans' understanding of religious liberty really is? Do they know what religious liberty is?
Well, I would say probably not, or at least not enough people understand what it is. I think most people in these answers are reflecting the fact that they think religious liberty is for themselves. Whether it's for other people, I think they're less clear about that, and they're less clear about how this arrangement in religious liberty works. In other words, they're for religious freedom generally, But then when you start asking them specific questions about how you apply it, then they're not so sure, for example, that that separation of church and state is a core principle of religious liberty. I'm not sure they make that connection. So they're for it, but then they don't realize that if we erode separation of church and state, if we allow government to be entangled with religion, we diminish religious freedom.
Charles, what else in this survey concerned you when you saw the results of it?
Well, I think what concerns me broadly is that the American people, I think, are willing to give up on the freedom side in order to be safer, more secure. I think a good many Americans don't know our history and don't understand what's at stake in upholding First Amendment rights for all people. I mean, even if in some of these answers, a third or 34 or 35% are in favor of discrimination against same-sex couples or whatever the issue is, that's a lot of people, more than a third of the people. And in the case of us being a Christian nation under the Constitution, that's a majority of the people. So the overall survey says to me, we've got work to do. On the education front, we've got to counter the voices out there that are misinforming the American people about our history or twisting our history to fit their vision of what they would like America to be. And we need to speak louder about our actual history and what the principles of the First Amendment really mean.
Are there any areas of the survey in which you found encouragement?
Yes, I think so. I am heartened by the fact that in this time of turmoil and chaos and when there's been so much fighting over religion in the United States and abroad, that a large majority of the American people believe that religious freedom is for everybody, including groups that are often called extreme or offensive. I'm heartened by that there is a sense in which, you know, religious freedom needs to apply broadly to people. That number has gone down a bit, but I think it's still strong and robust enough for us to say that there is kind of a gut support for religious freedom for everyone out there. So even though we have problems when people actually begin to apply it in different arenas, I think we have problems in understanding separation of church and state and why that's a core principle of religious freedom. My hope is, and my sort of optimism comes from the fact that I think most Americans really think that religious freedom applies to people, even people they disagree with or don't like, and that's a good thing. Fortunately, history is on our side, Walton. I mean, that is to say, what we're talking about when we talk about religious freedom in America is the boldest and most successful experiment in freedom of conscience in the world. You know, that's a great foundation for getting the American people on all sides to understand what's at stake and supporting it today and into the future.
Yeah. Dr. Charles Haynes is director of the Religious Freedom Education Project at the Newseum. We've been talking about the new State of the First Amendment survey from the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University and the Newseum. You can access the report at firstamendmentcenter.org. Charles, I really appreciate you being with us here today on State of Belief Radio, but I appreciate what you do across this land every day to make religious freedom a more secure blessing for all of us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Over the past few years, it's been a pleasure getting to know Chris Stedman. As a young atheist interfaith activist, he has in many ways blazed an original trail in the field of interreligious dialogue. Chris is the author of a terrific memoir, Faithiest: How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious, and he serves as the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard, which is why when recent debates regarding the possibility of including humanist chaplains in the U.S. Armed Forces caused a torrent of outrage and blind ignorance, I knew we needed to talk to Chris again. So, Chris Stedman, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Clearly, we need to just explain why this is a valid concept. So, Why don't you start there and describe also a little bit about your work in the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard?
Let me just begin by saying that I understand the confusion. I have a harder time understanding the hate and the vitriol, but I definitely understand the confusion around the term chaplain. For many people, the word chaplain clearly has religious connotations, and more often than not, those connotations are actually explicitly Christian. But like many words, the definition of chaplain has evolved over time. If you look at the history of chaplains in the military, initially only Christians could serve as chaplains. Then, not long after that, Jewish people could serve as well, but it would be another almost 150 years before there was the first Muslim chaplain in the U.S. Armed Forces. So though the term chaplain may have Christian connotations, it has evolved. If you look at Harvard, for example, where I currently work, you'll find nearly 40 chaplains that represent a wide array of religious and philosophical traditions and communities, from atheism and humanism to Swedenborgianism and Zoroastrianism. It really runs the gamut. And, you know, for many of the communities that have a chaplain at Harvard, the title of chaplain has little to no historical precedent whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But as a group, we collectively work to expand this definition because we see the role of chaplain as meeting a need of these diverse communities. And I don't feel all that attached to the title of chaplain. I mean, I really think of myself in many ways as a community organizer and as a care provider, as a practitioner. Mm-hmm. If you want to call that a chaplain, that's fine. If you don't, that's okay. But you know, I do think that it is an important conversation to have, because when the standard term used for somebody who is a community care practitioner or provider is chaplain in a given context, then I think that that term should be applied across the board. I have a similar feeling about the debate over whether legally recognized same-sex unions, partnerships, should be called marriages or civil unions. I mean, mm-hmm. I think when one term is the standard, is normative, and certain groups of people aren't given access to that term, especially when it's a group that's been historically marginalized, like mm-hmm. many non-religious and atheists have been, then there's a problem when only certain people have access to the term.
Some people have trouble with the word chaplain. Other people have trouble with the word atheist and who an atheist is. Some people who ought to know better grasp atheism as nothing more than not believing in anything.
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to take for people to start to understand, or maybe even first just want to understand, the word atheist and what that means?
Well, I think that this is definitely connected to the bridge-building, relationship-building work between atheists and other non-religious people and religious believers that you and I have discussed before. I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about who atheists are, what they do and do not believe. A lot of these misconceptions originate in long-standing anti-atheist bias. But I think one thing that atheists and humanists can do and are doing now is put ourselves out into the public square mm-hmm. and introduce ourselves as full individuals representing many different beliefs and convictions. And this is why I am an atheist, and I'm proud to be an atheist. It's not something I'm ashamed of. It's not something I shy away from. And I think that I use the term atheist a lot because I think it's important to own it and destigmatize it. But I'm also a humanist, and that's something that I really put at the forefront of my interactions with others, because, you know, I am an atheist, but there are also many things that I believe in, things that I stand for, values that I hold. And humanism is a worldview. It's a progressive philosophy of life that encompasses the values that I hold. And I think that atheists and humanists need to build these kinds of relationships with religious believers, where we have an opportunity to introduce ourselves as full human beings and to tell the story of what it means to be a humanist who believes in the possibility of collaboration, who believes in the potential of humanity to do good. I mean, I think, you know, as an atheist, I believe that there's probably no God and that there's probably no afterlife. And thus, I put my focus on the here and now. And I think that if there are no divine or supernatural forces that are going to intervene in human affairs and solve our problems for us, then it's up to human beings, religious and non-religious, to work together to build that the kind of world that we want to see, to respond to the human problems that we face. And I think that that is a story, and that is a set of ideas that is very consistent with a lot of the values and aspirations of many religious people. And I think that is a place where common ground can be found and where we can begin to challenge some of the longstanding systemic biases against atheists and humanists.
If you are serving as a chaplain, whether at Harvard or if in the military, probably even a broader group of people than those at Harvard, how do you as an atheist or a humanist chaplain deal with people in your chaplaincy work if some of them are people of faith?
Sure. Well, my job does not entail preaching, if you will. It does entail consciousness raising. So you might call that preaching if you want it. One of the things that I do is I try to communicate what humanism is and make information readily available. And this is something that chaplains can do in the military that, for example, psychologists cannot. And that's one of the common arguments that we hear is, you know, why do non-religious people in the military need chaplains? They can just go visit a psychologist, which is, I think, a really silly argument because it kind of implies that some religious people don't visit both chaplains and psychologists. And obviously, psychologists and chaplains do function in very different ways. And one of those differences is chaplains can actually go out and look for members of their own community. We can seek them out and let them know that we're available, which is something psychologists do not do. And so, you know, I don't have an agenda when I'm working with someone, whether they're religious or non-religious, to sort of move them one direction or the other. My job is to meet people where they are and help them identify resources and help them listen to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I just think, you know, the worry that humanist chaplains are going to infiltrate the military and try to deconvert people is a rather silly one, not a goal that I have. And certainly my job as a chaplain is about providing care for those who want it. But in the same way that many Christians would probably prefer a Christian chaplain over a Muslim or a Jewish chaplain, they prefer to sit down with someone who they feel sort of speaks the same language, believes similar things. I think that non-religious people should have the opportunity to have that resource as well. Now, does that mean that there are non-religious people in the military who aren't currently meeting with a religious chaplain and getting something from that interaction? I'm sure that happens, but for those who would prefer to sit down with someone who they feel is representative of what they believe, I think that option should be available.
Yeah. Chris, I know you've been doing a lot of traveling and speaking. As you talk to people about interfaith issues from a humanist perspective, are there some themes that you find coming up again and again? I guess I'm wanting to ask, what are you learning about the opportunities and challenges of the kind of dialogue that you're working so hard to promote?
One of the things that I really see emerging is that interfaith work that brings together people who are of different religious backgrounds, but have sort of similar values. You know, let's say, for example, people who are politically progressive and very similar to one another in that sense. That kind of interfaith organizing is valuable, and there is a real need for it in a world in which the loudest voices all rise to the top and the more progressive or moderate voices tend to get drowned out. But I think that there is an increasing desire for and hunger for conversation with people who fundamentally disagree with you on very significant issues. You know, I've had the opportunity to speak at some evangelical Christian colleges. Were I a student, you know, I could potentially be kicked out for being gay or for being an atheist. I've had an opportunity to speak at a conference co-sponsored by Brigham Young University. I mean, I've had several chances to step into environments where I am very clearly the other and where I know going in that there is not going to be consensus on some issues that are very important to me. And honestly, those conversations have been perhaps the most fruitful of any that I've had.
Yeah.
And so I am seeing more and more that there's a great interest in moving beyond simply, you know, talking to people who have different worldviews but are on a similar page politically and really having a different kind of conversation between communities that have historically been really opposed to one another.
Chris Stedman is the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard University and the author of the memoir Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. And I understand, Chris, that the paperback edition of that will be out in October, right?
That's right, yeah.
I just have to tell you, I always resent the fact that you wrote your autobiography at 25, I'm still trying to write one, but I want to talk more next time about what you're doing next, and I know that it could be almost anything, but...
well, first of all, you better write it, because I will be among the first to buy it and read it, and second of all, thanks again for having me on, and I'm really looking forward to the next time we get to talk.
Goodness, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by generous donations from listeners just like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to us today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. StateofBelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for podcasts and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show, and we encourage them to listen to, and I hope you'll help us with that. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.